Hi, this is Alan Chartok. The Supreme Court began argument this week involving a clash between organized labor and conservative groups in a case that could overturn decades-old precedent and deal a potentially crippling blow to public sector unions. The court is hearing a challenge to an Illinois law that allows government employee unions to collect fees from workers who chose not to join. At the center of the issue is Mark Janis, an Illinois public sector employee who says that because he's a government employee, issues germane to collective bargaining are inherently political. He argues that the First Amendment protects him from having to support such political expression in the case. The 1977 Supreme Court opinion known as Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. It says while non-members of public sector unions cannot be required to pay fees for a union political activity, they can be required to pay so-called fair share fees pertaining to costs such as employee grievances, physical safety, and training. The Abood decision was a careful compromise when it came down years ago. But in recent years, some conservative members of the Supreme Court have publicly questioned whether it should be overturned today. According to CNN, 22 states have laws on the books that allow broad fair share fees for public employees. Joining us in conversation today to talk about the case is Mario Cilento, president of the New York State AFL-CIO, and Andrew Pallotta, president of the New York State United Teachers Union, NYSUT. New York State AFL-CIO President Cilento has served as a commissioner of the New York State Insurance Fund and on the executive boards of the Workforce Development Institute and the Working Theater. President Cilento graduated from Fordham University in 1990 with a Bachelor's of Science degree. NYSUT President Andrew Pallotta is a grassroots activist and former elementary school teacher. Pallotta previously served as NYSUT Executive Vice President, directing NYSUT's political mobilization and legislative efforts. Terrific to have both of you here. It couldn't be more timely. Thanks so much for showing up.
Thank you, Alan, for having us.
Gentlemen, let's start with an understanding of what the Janis decision is, what Janis is arguing, and whether the people who are listening to this program might think he has a point. That's where it gets very dangerous for the unions. So who would like to go first and sort of tell us what you think?
Well, Alan, first of all, thanks for having us. Look, this is not just about Mr. Janis. If it was, it would be a simpler issue. The fact is, this is a all-out and unprecedented assault on working men and women, on the middle class in this country, and organized labor, particularly our public sector unions. This case is being backed by the Liberty Justice Center, who's providing the lawyers for Mr. Janis. They also have connections to the Koch brothers, no fans of the organized labor movement. So this isn't really about only Mr. Janis, and we'll get to him in a second. This is about corporate America, the top 1% in this country, saying they'd rather have lower wages, benefits, and conditions of employment for working men and women so that they can continue to have higher share prices and higher pay for their corporate CEOs. That's what this is really about. There's a clear line between who's backing this case, who's been talking about it for the last few years, and where we are today. The fact of the matter is this, Alan, is that those behind this case get very concerned with the fact that organized labor represents their workers in the workplace and allows them to make better wages, benefits, and conditions of employment. The Bureau of Labor Statistics just last year in 2017 came out with a study that showed, on average, union members in this country make $11,000 more a year than non-union members. That's a lot of money for anyone, but particularly if you're in the middle class. I mean, you can have two families living in an apartment building doing basically the same job, one of them making $40,000 a year, another one making $51,000 a year, the only difference being that one of them is a member of a union. That is very concerning to those on the conservative right-wing ideological scale who'd rather have that money going back into shareholder earnings. That's really the crux of this argument. And as for Mr. Janis, and we can talk about this now or later, the fact of the matter is this. Mr. Janis has been a member of his union for 11 years. 11 years. So I guess the question is, and this is not rhetorical, Alan, maybe you have the answer to this. Is Mr. Janis going to give back, what, it's 11 years, that's $122,000 in earnings on average? Even if he doesn't make $11,000 more than a union member. Say he makes only $5,000 more than a non-union member. Is he going to give up $55,000? Has he written a check back to the state of Illinois for earnings that he's made? Is he foregoing his health care that was negotiated by his union? Is he now going to pay for it every time he goes for a doctor's visit? Is he going to do all those things? Has he done those things? I'd like to know, because you can't have it both ways. You can't accept wages for 11 years and say, well, I'm making too much money. The state of Illinois can't afford it. You can't say I'm going to collect health care for 11 years that takes care of yourself and your family, and then all of a sudden say, you know what, the state of Illinois can't afford it. So I would like to know where exactly Mr. Janus has been for 11 years and what he's done with all of the excess earnings that he's earned over the last 11 years by virtue of the fact that his union, by the way, when Mr. Janus walked into that office 11 years ago and accepted the job, there was already in place a democratically elected union. They were democratically elected. They're just not there. At some point in time, a group of people joined together and said, we want to have a collective voice in the workplace. Mr. Janus knew that when he walked into the office. I would say this. I believe he works in some kind of child services, which is a noble profession. There are other jobs in Illinois that he could have taken. And I don't know what the union rate in Illinois is. And here in New York, it's 24%, the highest in the country. But there are certainly more, I would think, non-union jobs in that area than union jobs. He could have taken that job, made less money, and he would have seemingly been happy with it. But he made the conscious decision 11 years ago to walk into that office, take that job, take the money, take the health care. I'm assuming he's going to have a pension, although that's probably done legislatively in Illinois as it is here in New York State. So here we are today. So do you have any of those answers, Alan? Because I don't.
Well, first of all, you're not going to get much of a fight from me where my emotions
are. No, and I appreciate that. You might have more information.
I was a union member, faculty member at New Paltz in Albany, you know, for almost 40 years. You know, and I wouldn't have thought of not paying my dues if you know, I could have. My mother thought that Albert Shanker was very close to God.
So did my mother. He was a UFT member.
A lot of people
had
that.
And so I was raised in that environment. Nevertheless, my job here, of course, is to test you guys and to ask the questions as to why the average Joe will side with you or side with Janus. And I think there are plenty of average Joes who will side with Janus and say, if you're spending all your money to get Democratic legislators elected or a Democratic governor elected, and he's a Republican, why should he give you money for that?
That's a fair point. But here's the thing to keep in mind. When a union goes and supports a candidate for office, and by the way, in this state, at least, we support Republicans and Democrats. Maybe it's a little different across the country. I'm sure, I know it is.
Yes, but it's a unique situation.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
But even broadly, keep in mind, to that average person out there who may not understand this completely, when a union goes out and they lobby for legislation or they go out and they work for a particular candidate for office, they are doing that because that particular candidate shows an understanding of the needs and concerns of all working people. So it's not as if Union X is going out there and they are lobbying on gun control. They're not going out and lobbying on abortion laws. They are going out in a very finely constricted area, which is workplace issues. The collective bargaining area is pretty straightforward. Wages, benefits.
Well, to stop you for a minute, gun control might very well be a workplace issue for teachers.
It could be, yes. But again, not in the greater sense of lobbying for or against it. So we have a very specific set of issues that we lobby on that will ultimately affect not only the working life, but maybe the post-working life of working men and women. So I think that's really important for the average person to understand. So when we talk about Democrats or Republicans, it's not of those greater issues. Any of the money that is collected for political activity is used, therefore, for issues that affect those members. And keep in mind also, and Andy will talk about this much greater detail than I can, there is already the right of public sector workers who are choosing not to be part of the union to be reimbursed for their political fees.
Well, how does that work, that alternative? Could you describe that?
I think Andy can probably do a little bit.
Well, what we have at NYSET is something called VOCOPE. It's voluntary contributions. And what we do with that money is we support and advocate for the particular positions that the union has adopted. So right now, key for us is the budget at the Capitol, and we have supported legislators that support public education and public health. So each and every day, we have our folks at the Capitol lobbying for that. It is something that we do for everyone, whether someone is an agency fee payer, a full-paying member, they are lobbying for them. So it's not just a contract, but it is a contract, it is benefits, it is pension, all those things that everyone profits by being part of our union.
Well, just to keep it straight, I want to get this. Is there any alternative to being in the agency shop?
In New York State, it's a voluntary contribution to the political action of the union. And we have folks that really, really support every position that we have. We have folks that we support that are Republicans, Democrats, independents, and we have done this for many, many years. So it is not union dues money going to political advocacy.
So choice in this state, just so we get it straight, is that in New York State, as you speak, Andy, is that you can either give or not give to the political fund, but you pay the agency fee.
Correct. Correct.
All right.
And that fund is sizable because our members do want us to advocate for them.
So let me ask you both, what is the downside to all of this? If you lose in the Supreme Court, and there are many who think you will, what do you lose?
Well, I think, first of all, you lose some members who just feel as though they don't have to pay their dues now or their fair share fees, and they won't do that.
So remembering that half the American electorate doesn't vote, so you're quite right.
I understand. Right. Right. So you have an opportunity here where there will be some members who just won't pay even their fair share fees. What that means, I think, and again, Andy can speak to this more directly, whereas I represent the umbrella of the AFL-CIO, is that you're going to have a lot of unions who have already been doing this for the last few years, I think, reconnecting with their members, talking to them, really getting their point of view, educating them on exactly why it's important to continue to pay dues, why it's important to keep the union strong, why it's important to have a voice in the workplace. So I think there's a redoubling of efforts. I think that's one of the ramifications of this. I think possibly we could come out stronger than this long term. I think for the short term, you're going to have, probably will have a little bit less dues money coming in for some of the public sector unions. But ultimately, I think the reality of reconnecting with the members and educating them on again, why it's so important to have a union in the workplace, you can come out ahead long term. And I'd like to keep this in mind, too, particularly here in New York State. You know, we have over 2 million members in the state of New York. Half are public sector. The other half are private and building trades. So for us as a labor movement, we really won't be affected all that much simply because we have another million on the other side of it who aren't affected by this at all. And as Andy said, the vast majority will continue to pay their dues. You're going to have some who aren't. And again, this is really a matter of fairness. This is about if you decide not to pay anything at all, and you're allowed to do that, you will still get and reap the benefits of a better collective bargaining agreement with higher wages, benefits, and better conditions of employment. Whereas the people who are paying dues, you know, it's not quite fair.
Carrying you.
Right. They're sort of carrying your water. And that doesn't seem quite fair.
It seems to me the analogy here could be getting a flu shot. If you don't get it, you put other people at danger.
Right. Well, and think about it this way. You know, for those who are considering not paying their dues, if this goes forward, I'd ask them to keep in mind 2 or 3 years from now when their next collective bargaining agreement is up. And if that particular union, not necessarily here in New York, but across the country, is even weakened a bit,
yeah,
I can pretty much bet that that next contract isn't going to be as good as the contract they have now. And again, that's another thing. 2 or 3 years from now, after contracts are negotiated again across this country, and maybe they're not quite as good as the prior contract when the union was at full strength, they're going to probably want to start paying their dues again because they're not going to be happy. So there's going to be a little bump in the road here. I don't think anybody would argue with that. But long term, I think we'll see it redouble the efforts to get back to where we are now.
And there are states like Wisconsin that when they went right to work, their workers now have reduced pay, reduced benefits, and it's a direct impact from the right to work folks. The corporate moneyed folks that are trying to destroy unions, to destroy a voice in the workplace, it's crucial for us. And as teachers, as educators, as college professors, as the folks that we represent in hospitals, that they have a voice in the workplace. Our unions give us that voice.
Isn't there something to be said on the part of managers or of the money class to support agency shops, for example? You know, I mean, do you really want to have to start going out and dealing with individual people, unions? If you destroy a union, you know, you really can't come to a conclusion about how everybody's going to get treated. Am I wrong?
This is really short-sighted on behalf of the corporate 1% and the corporate American 1%. Here's the reason why. In the 28 right-to-work states that we have, wages are 12% lower across the board than in the 22 non-right-to-work states.
That's interesting.
So as a result, what you have is, and as I said, that's why this isn't only an attack on the public sector unions. This is about all working people in the middle class, because if wages go down, if unions don't hold the line on wage floors, what happens is the general public eventually makes less, which means you have less money to go out and buy what? Goods and services that corporate America is selling you every day of the week. So it's really short. It really is short-sighted. And again, I would ask everyone to really consider this. When the labor movement is strong, we don't only raise or improve the lives of working men and women. We really do raise the standard and quality of life for all working people. And I'll give you a quick example, Alan. Over the last few years, 2 years ago, as you well know, we were at the forefront of the fight for a $15 minimum wage. We have 2 million members in this state. 100,000 of them make between $9 an hour and $15 an hour. So when the legislation is written, it doesn't just say a $15 minimum wage for union members. When we passed paid family leave last year, the AFL, I hate to say it, we worked on it for 15 years, but we finally got it done 2 years ago. It doesn't say paid family leave, but only for union members. And I think that's also, I hope that the general public really understands that when we are strong, we do raise the tide on all of those boats across the board, and it's not just union members that benefit. And that's what's really concerning, I think, to corporate America. And I'll say one other thing. I think the general public is starting to recognize it. Last year, the most recent Gallup poll showed that support for labor unions in this country is now at 63%, which is the highest we've been in two decades. That usually comes about when people start to recognize a growing income inequality.
Or when Donald Trump is the president.
Or when Donald Trump is the president. But recognizing that, that really does lead eventually to growing income inequality. So they recognize then that they need to have, whether they're a union member or not, they start to recognize that the only way you're going to be able to fight back against corporate billionaires is by joining together with one voice. And I know that sounds trite, but the fact of the matter is people start to recognize it. So you see those poll numbers go up. They recognize the 12% difference between right to work and non-right to work. And you start to see a trend here where people are starting to realize if we don't join together, and you're seeing it a lot now on other issues, like you see that in Florida with that, the only way to get anything done, it seems, is to exert enough pressure on those who hold some power. And what this is an attack to keep everyone who wants to join together back down.
So the Daily News, in an editorial as we speak, says they're on your side.
Yep.
You know, they're on your side. But they take a shot. They say that you guys are increasingly aggressive, sometimes obnoxious in your political activities.
That's good. That's a good thing. We're aggressive. We should be aggressive because we owe the dues-paying members everything that we have to improve the lives of them and their families. I mean, I grew up in a union. I grew up in the Bronx in the 70s and 80s. My father was a Local 3 member, an electrician. My mother was a paraprofessional at PS 45 in the Bronx. And I recognized the difference between, now they struggled, and I had everything that I needed, not necessarily everything that I wanted, but we recognized the difference that a union made in our household. And I think, you know, cases like this, where you have people saying, well, unions shouldn't be aggressive. Well, if they weren't aggressive, first of all, I don't know how I would have gotten to Fordham University with my parents paying out student loans and being able to, I paid off some of them, but doing what they did, being able to give us what they could. I don't see where being aggressive to promote the interest. My father went to had a pension if he wasn't a member of Local 3.
Okay, so let's say, Mario, let's say aggressive is, you've argued well on the aggressive issue. How about obnoxious?
Well, I mean, that's pretty subjective, right? I mean, you could say I'm obnoxious just, you know, because you don't like it.
I don't think you're obnoxious, Mario.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Obnoxious, look, this is... You can characterize someone's demeanor or an organization's demeanor and how they go about things in a lot of different ways. The name calling is really below the Daily News. The fact of the matter is this. They do believe, I saw the editorial, they do believe that workers deserve to have and should and need to have a voice in the workplace. That's the bottom line. How hard we fight for the members we represent, I think we should wear that as a badge of honor.
Right, and that's one of the things we do. Each and every time we have an opportunity, we fight, and we fight aggressively for our members. That's what we're here for.
Andy, Mario, I wanted to ask you this. Unions are not in great repute in this country. Mario points out that they're growing in popularity right now under these conditions. Nevertheless, is there something that the unions could be doing that would make people, John Q. Public out there, more amenable towards their activities? Because an awful lot, I mean, union membership is basically pretty low in this country compared to what it's been and all the rest. What's your job? What do you have to do?
That's a great question. We're actually talking about that now in terms of, I think when you saw the Constitutional Convention issue.
Yeah.
General Public voted for that at 83%. Our members, we did a poll, voted at 87%. So it was across the board. It wasn't just our members, but the
you
general
voted
public
against, voted against it.
What did I say? Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I voted against it. union members and non-union members. There was a lot for a lot of people to lose. And we started to talk certainly to our members, but we did little things. Like we had lawn signs out. We had bumper stickers. I went over the George Washington Bridge yesterday into Manhattan, and I'm still going behind cars who still have those bumper stickers on the back of their cars. I think we can do a better job of maybe promoting ourselves. We don't always think of it in those terms of wanting to really, we try to be Daily News and Obnoxious Aside, be as humble as we can possibly be. But I think we can do a better job of sort of promoting it. There was an initiative in the 80s, Union Yes, that was across this country about promoting union. I think part of it is it cost a little bit of money to do it. And I think resources at this time, I think, are really, we're trying to focus them on organizing and that sort of thing. And Andy could speak to that. But I will say this, that, again, to get back to the point of what the general public is seeing in terms of the value of union membership, Bureau of Labor Statistics last year came out with a report at the end of December. We added 75,000 new union members in the state of New York last year. Across this country, we added 260,000 new union members across this country. So I think that, coupled with the polling and coupled with the turnout in the Constitutional Convention and all the other things, the attacks in Wisconsin on public sector unions, I think we're beginning to see it. I think it's our responsibility now as a labor movement to take advantage of that and maybe do a little bit of a better job educating the general public on it as to why we exist and why, even if they're not a member themselves, that we do really raise the standard of living and quality of life for all people. And, we have a responsibility.
And yet, people will sit back and they'll remember the corruption influences, you know, organized crime in the Teamsters Union and stuff, and transport that thinking to every other union, which certainly is not true in, if I may say, in our union. But it is the kind of impression that people have with the boss of the union with a cigar in his mouth in a Cadillac riding along. Neither of you look this way to me.
Well, thank you.
And
we believe in transparency in our finances and in being good stewards of that finance that our members do give us. So it is something where we fight each and every day to make sure that we're clear with our message. Our message is that we stand up for them. Coalitions, talking about coalitions, the Constitutional Convention. We formed a group with the AFL-CIO. There must have been 200 coalitions that were part of that. And that's
what
the reason.
What were you really frightened about there? They were going to change the Constitution. They were going to take pro-labor provisions out. Is that what you were worried about?
Collective bargaining. It would impact working people around the state.
We have the strongest labor protection in our state constitution of any state in the country. So, you know, you cannot diminish a public sector pension. So for public sector workers, that's obviously very important. The pension you retire on is a pension you have for the rest of your life. Prevailing rate laws for building trades workers, which is the higher rate by industry. You have workers' compensation. Again, union member or non-union member. Unemployment insurance, that's written into the Constitution. The eight-hour day, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to take away the eight-hour day, but I can see someone setting a case and saying, well, we only want you to work 7 hours and 45 minutes a day. Well, there's 15 minutes of pay. So, I mean, so there was a lot to lose in that campaign, and I think that resonated with the members, and I think it started to make them realize, wait a second, I have some of these protections because my labor union fought for them 50, 60, 70 years ago. So I think you start to see that. And as I said earlier, I think we have to take advantage of that.
Let's go to one you just went over very quickly, and that was prevailing wage. That's something that I don't think everybody does believe in. You know, the idea that if you pay somebody on one level, then you have to pay everybody the same thing. Is that defensible?
Absolutely. We're using tax dollars for those projects. So if we're going to use tax dollars for those projects, we should get the most highly trained, highly skilled professional workforce that you have in the area. What you don't want to start doing...
Mario, explain prevailing wage so that everybody understands what it is.
Well, when you take public tax dollars for a construction project, and it's used for whatever, to build a road or a bridge, that prevailing wage is the standard in that particular area of the state. So you may have a certain prevailing wage standard in the Hudson Valley that is certainly different than Buffalo or New York City. And that wage will be across the standard. There's a carpenter's wage, there's a laborer's wage, there's an electrician's wage. And the theory behind it is that if you're going to use taxpayer dollars, you want to be able to raise those wages, A, to be fair to the workers on those projects, and to make sure that, in fact, you're getting a higher quality of work with a more highly trained and highly skilled workforce. And then, in essence, you know, those workers are taxpayers. The money that they use, that earn, goes right back into the local economy because they're in that area of the state. So they're able to go to the dry cleaner. They're maybe able to go to dinner at night, go to the movies on the weekend. So you don't want to have a situation where we're using tax dollars to drive down wages.
And yet there are those who argue this prevailing wage thing can be kind of ugly if you say that the guy who's working, you know, in upstate New York in Canajoharie, the New York City prevailing wage would have to be applied to Canajoharie.
No, there's a wage for New York City. There's a wage for each individual.
Okay, Mario, if you had your way,
right.
Would you say, okay, there ought to be one prevailing wage in New York State?
Well, it really depends. I mean, I'd want to take the highest wage, right? I mean, that's my job is to say that. So obviously New York City would be the highest wage. I would, but to your point, that's not how it works, which is helpful to that local economy, to that local tax base. So they're not going to pay money that they necessarily couldn't afford. In other words, pay a New York City rate up in Buffalo. They're going to pay whatever that prevailing rate is in that area of the state, which is built in a measure of
fairness. As it stands now, but I think you just admitted that if you had your way, there would be one prevailing wage for all of New York State.
I'd have to think about it a little bit more, but I would just say this. My job is to advocate for the highest wage possible, but within reason to allow that particular entity, that particular area of the state, to be able to do the job well, pay the workers fairly, and also get a good return on that investment for the local community.
Okay, so you guys must be huddling. You must be talking to each other, and you must be saying, okay, let's say we lose this. And as I said in the beginning, I think there's a good chance you are going to lose it. I think it's going to be a 5-4 decision. I think the appointment of Gorsuch will mean that the Scalia vote will be there, and that's what they're going to do. So when you huddle, what are you arguing with each other about? What are you thinking that can be done to ameliorate this tough situation?
Well, the main thing is that we connect with our membership. And we've been doing a door-knocking campaign, reaching out to each and every member of NYSET all throughout the state.
And that's the New York State United Teachers, for those who are listening and may have joined us later. Go ahead.
Right. So we're doing that, and we're talking to them about what is important to them. What do they want from their union? And we meet folks from all backgrounds and all perspectives, and Republicans and Democrats, and we have some great conversations with them. We're also doing that in the workplace. So this is an ongoing, never-ending project.
Give me specifics. I mean, what will you do if you lose this and your income goes down as a result of it? Is something crippling the union movement, which is exactly what the guys who are proposing this want to have happen? How do you make it up?
Well, what we're trying to do is make sure that our members know what they get from their union so they stick with their union. That is the gist of this entire campaign of reconnecting.
Yeah.
If they realize that their union is the only one fighting for them, whether it's for pay, benefits, pensions, they know that they need to stick with their union. When I was a teacher, for 24 years, and the ceiling was falling down in my classroom, and that ceiling was made with asbestos, I remember I connected with the union. And it was the union that came through for us. So knowing what your union is able to do for you keeps you in that union. We want to be able to keep them in the union for the voice, not just for the union member, but that ceiling with the asbestos was falling on the students, right? So we're fighting for the students. We're making sure that they have a healthy and safe workplace. So without the union, where are their voices? That's why we're saying stick with the union.
So is there a way that members of a union can tell who isn't paying, who has decided not to pay?
I'm sure there is. You know, there would be.
This could really cause a certain amount of internal strife, could it not?
Well, I would think so, because in the school I worked in many years ago, people still remembered from the days of Al Shanker who didn't go on strike, who didn't support the other folks that did go on strike, that did pay the price for going out and making their voices heard. So, yes, it would be a very uncomfortable thing for one person not to be in the union, not paying their fair share, and yet reaping all the benefits of being part of an organized group that is working for them.
So let me ask you both a question, and Mario and Andy. Trump is the president of the United States right now. How he got there, I don't know, but he did. And unbelievably, we've just lived through 1 year of 4 years. There's 3 more years to go. What are you worried about?
I'm worried about everything, Alan. But I would say this. We've seen him for a year. We have a little more than 2.5 years until the next election. So we can look at it that way, I guess. But I think a continued diminishment of the rights of working men and women. Remember, he appointed Neil Gorsuch, so that's his frame of mind. That's his frame of references. He has a cabinet that's made up completely of millionaires and billionaires, and I've said this many times. That doesn't make them bad people. If you're successful financially, more power to you. I applaud you for that. The problem is that the people that Donald Trump, if he's listening to anyone, his frame of reference is only those millionaires and billionaires. That's the issue. His frame of reference isn't anyone who grew up like I grew up or Andy grew up or anyone that, at least that I know. And when you limit yourself to a certain point of view and only have that point of view, and in this case, a point of view that does not really understand and appreciate the everyday life of working men and women, that single mother making $25,000 a year or a family of four with two working parents making $60,000 a year, you know, in the five boroughs of New York City where that money is not going very far. When you don't have that frame of reference, you are apt to make decisions that disadvantage those who you're not familiar with. And I think that's what I'm most concerned about. I can talk to you about a lot of different laws, you know, whether it was healthcare, whether it's tax policy, whether it's infrastructure and where that's going to go. There are a lot of different issues that we can talk about, but I think that's secondary to the fact that his frame of reference is such that he really does not understand where we are and what we have to do as a country to raise that standard of living and quality of life for the middle class in this country. And that's why I open this by saying this isn't just an attack on public sector unions. This is an attack on all working people, whether you're a union person or not. And I think our members understand this because we've been really talking about this for 2.5 to 3 years when it was originally the Friedrichs case before Justice Scalia passed away. Sure. So there's also that. There's been an education and reconnecting process for 3 years now. So we're ahead of the game from where we were two and a half years ago. So for me, it's more along the lines of that broader message where President Trump doesn't seem as though he's going to at any point surround himself with people who really understand what it's like to have to earn a living every single day. And if you get laid off for a month, your family is in debt for a year. And I think that's really the greater question here. So what concerns me, Alan, is the fact that the president has no frame of reference for the vast majority of the 330 million citizens of this country.
And yet somehow he got to be president. So I wanted to ask both of you this. One of the accusations that has been made against the unions and their political activity is that you guys are always going to be for the Democrats. Now, Mario, you made a point that in New York State, the unions made a decision years ago to keep the Senate Republican because the Republicans would go along with what...
That was only our decision, but okay.
Yeah, no, but no, it's not only yours, but... Right. But really, a decision that unions, guys like Norman Adler and other people made early in the game to follow that philosophy. Is there a danger of sticking with one side too much? I raise that with you because the governor, Andrew Cuomo, is in a lot of trouble right now. There's a major trial going on among his top people. He has moved fairly left as fast as he could, and we all know it. And some people, Ed Cox and the Republican Party, pro-Trumper obviously, are yelling that this is the most corrupt administration in history. What do you do about it? Do you put your heads together and say, hey, we have to counsel with this governor, or we have to say, what are you doing? I mean, what do you do?
We have at NYSET a very democratic process on who we endorse. So our local leaders, our PAC, our board of directors, we get together for three beautiful days in August, and then we get together with the AFL-CIO. So our membership has input into who we endorse. So yes, our members are Democrats. They are Republicans. They want us to support folks that would support us. Members of the legislature that have been advocates for public education, those are the folks that we're going to support. And if they happen to be, many of them, Democrats, then it seems like we're endorsing a lot of Democrats. But we have also endorsed a lot of Republicans throughout the years. And that is part of who we are as NYSET. We are a reflection of our membership.
I would say this. We have more than 2 million members in the state, Alan. We have 3,000 local unions. So I can tell you this. I have 49 executive board members at the state AFL-CIO who represent the largest unions in the state, whether it's 1199 or NYSET or the TWU and so on and so forth. So when you have an umbrella organization like this, you have to take into account where your unions are and where your affiliates are and where their members are. And, you know, we do have a good number of unions in this state who work with Republican leadership, those who work with the Democratic leadership. So for us, it has always been, we try to take it each individual candidate. How that breaks out, I mean, this is a blue state as it is, so it's not going to be so surprising that we endorse more Democrats than Republicans. But, and again, I can only speak for New York, we have endorsed, in some years, 40% of our endorsements are Republican, or close to it, which is much higher than the rest of the country.
I tried to explain that before, because the state senate has been in power for a long time.
No.
And you guys have been helping keep him there.
Well, I would say this. We're going to help to keep, and I'm not ashamed to say we're going to help to keep each individual lawmaker who we feel understands the needs and concerns of working men and women. I'd like to say I have all this power, Alan, but I would also caution to say that if we don't endorse someone who has supported the values or the goals of the labor movement, each individual lawmaker, then what are we doing?
Look, Mario, you are very powerful. No matter what anybody says, you are very powerful. When you guys walk into what Andy calls a open and democratic and transparent convention, you have leaders, and the leaders certainly know how to lead, and they certainly know how to tell people. The Republicans in the state Senate, as I have said, understood how to behave in order to continue to keep themselves there. But it does look like it might change now, and that the Democrats might turn around and take the Senate. Might. We've heard this before. We think Governor Cuomo has, like you guys, have been instrumental in keeping them where they are. So my question to you is, if they turn around and it looks like the Democrats are going to take the Senate, or if they do take the Senate, will you be less likely to endorse Republicans?
No. No. I would say this. I can say it a lot of different ways. Alan, I would just say this also. There really are 32 elected Democrats in the state Senate. Keep that in mind. They've broken up into three different entities, right?
With the Senate. Yeah, but we all
Spelder
know.
And then the IDC and the DNC.
Yeah,
so,
we all know what's
so
going
I
on.
Think we, right, well, no, we do. But my point is this. Regardless of who is in leadership, it's my responsibility at the AFL-CIO to have a relationship with that leader and then further the cause of the legislative goals of the labor movement. So I will work just as well or just as closely with whomever leads the Senate Dems, if they're in the majority, as we work now with Senator Flanagan.
There is an issue I'd like to address with you both, and that is people regard the legislature as a den of corruption, and yet they're the ones who make the decisions, and the governor makes the decisions. How do you avoid the stink of dealing with them landing on you? Not a very precise question. But
no. So, well, look, here's the thing. Again, we have a responsibility, Andy and myself, whether you're a labor leader, whether you're the head of the business council, whether you're head of the Adirondack and environmental groups, everyone who comes to Albany to lobby on behalf of the issues important to their members, you have a responsibility to work with whomever is in charge. And yes, there have been a lot of incidents in the state legislature over the last 20 or 30 years, obviously. How do you get it to not... You have to put your head down, do the right thing, advocate for your members, and do it the right way. What happens outside of that in any walk of life is what you're going to deal with. I mean, there's corruption in pretty much every aspect of life because that's human nature.
Yeah, but the more power people have, the more corrupt they are.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree. I mean, I think it's incumbent upon whether you're a labor leader, a business leader, a head of an environmental group, or any advocacy group, to do things in an above board manner, and then you let the chips fall where they may. I don't know how else we could possibly do it.
Right. When we advocate for those that are in power, right? We say we would want certain things to be on the agenda this year. We would want more funding for education. We would want the hospitals to be fully funded. This is what we advocate for, no matter who is in power. So it's our job. We're sent to Albany as officers of NYSET to do that, no matter who is in power.
Now, maybe I'm wrong about this, but one can figure that if the Democrats are in control in New York State, more of what you just said, Andy, is going to happen than if a conservative Republican is in charge. I recently interviewed John DeFrancisco, one of the Senate leaders, who is a prominent potential gubernatorial candidate, and he was pretty strong about how New York is spending too much money. So you guys know what the choices are going to be, don't you?
Yeah, we look at things like, what do the regents say? What do those leaders in education say we need for more funding for education? And if they're saying we need something like $1.8 billion or $2 billion in an increase in education funding, we're sticking with them saying that's what we need. These are the experts. So putting less into education, we will never be on that side of this debate.
So let's talk about women. It's the year of a woman. Me Too is happening. Unions, I take it, are as sensitive to this issue as anybody else is. What are you doing about it?
We have legislation that we've proposed dealing with sexual harassment in the workplace, making sure that we have stricter standards. There are more protections for whistleblowers, so on and so forth. So that was put in January. And we're working with both houses now to get that done. I know the governor has been out there as well. I think we'll get something meaningful done, but we're ahead of the curve. You know, we've always fought for equal protections in the workplace, even before the Me Too movement really came to be. I have three daughters, and you know, they're not quite at the age where they're in the workplace yet, but we have a responsibility to certainly protect those who are in the workplace now, and hopefully by the time my daughters get into the workforce, never have to deal with some of the things that many of our female co-workers have had to go through. So I'm comfortable with that. That is part of our legislative agenda, and I do think we'll get something done before the end of session.
Yeah, but forget about the state in general. How about within the union?
Mm-hmm.
Are you taking as strong actions as you can to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen there?
You go first, and then I'll...
We have a membership that is probably over three-quarters women. And NYSET has always been at the forefront on equality for all of our members. And we have our executive vice president, Jolene DeBrango, has started a fantastic group within the union, the Women's Committee, and bringing all of our women's issues forward and making them a priority for us as we go through our narrative of who we are as a union. Yes, we connect with our members because we are made up of members who look like the membership. We are folks who stand up for their rights, and we believe at our very core.
When you make an Andy and Mario, when you make appointments within the union, are you aware, as we are here at Public Radio, you know, that this is a place we can't compromise? We have to have a huge representation of women running the place. In fact, we try to make it more than 50-50 here.
We agree, and we try and make sure that our leadership, our directors, are diverse at NYSET. So even within the union itself, we have a very diverse workforce, and that is something that we keep at the forefront.
At the state AFL-CIO, about 8 to 10 years ago, we put in certain protocols in terms of policy for staff, and we've strengthened them over the years. So I think New York is a little bit ahead of the curve. This predates me, so I'm not taking credit for it as president. What we've seen now is that the national AFL-CIO on a national level the last year to 2 years have put together additional protocols with training and sensitivity courses for union leaders, which I think is very important because a lot of times you have union leaders who are coming from the ranks and may not really understand what it's like to work in an office. You work in the field and all of a sudden you're in office the next day and you're dealing with people that you may not have always dealt with outside. So I'm pleased to see that the national AFL-CIO has put certain parameters in place in terms of processes to deal with state labor federations and area labor federations and the smaller central labor councils throughout the country. So there is that. And as I said, I think it's even more important for the labor movement to have a sort of a higher standard in terms of how we deal with the issue, because we advocate for workers. So I have responsibility to try to run an office that has even a higher standard in our treatment of all employees, race, religion, culture, sexual orientation, ethnicity. I have that responsibility because it'd be hypocritical for me to go advocate and lobby and speak to the governor and both houses of the legislature and fighting for the rights of working men and women when I can't even do that in my own workplace. So I am pleased that we've had certain protocols in place. We've tightened them up a bit and supplemented with the national AFL-CIO's newly instituted rules and regulations. I'm comfortable with where we are right now.
Yeah, guys.
We can always improve.
We can. But what happens when those people, when you're advocating for change, which is resented by some of the members of the union? Certainly you must get some pushback on some of this.
Well, you will get some pushback because NYSET is a 680,000 member union, so you will get some pushback, but we believe we're on the right course. Representing a very diverse membership, we want to make sure that we respect everyone, that we put the dignity of every single member first. And we will keep with that. That is our course. That is where we have been for years. And I believe even though times are very turbulent, we will not change that course. So we will respect our members, whether they are women, men, gay, straight, it doesn't matter. This is who we are. And I think that gives us strength that we are a diverse union, that we are able to identify with the state of New York, and that in that strength, our members see power. They see that power, and that sometimes is a political power to change things in this state.
So, Mario, as the head of the state AFL-CIO, I wonder if you'd be kind enough to tell us what it's like to be out there relating to the other heads of AFL-CIOs in other states. In other words, obviously, this is a fairly progressive state. What happens when you have to argue for these very changes you're talking about?
Well, I think they recognize a couple of things. I think when I speak to my counterparts in other states, regardless of whether it's a blue state or a red state or a more progressive state or a liberal or a conservative state, I think the leadership is in tune with where we need to go on this issue in particular and also other progressive issues. I think they recognize that New York usually, and again, predating me, takes the lead on a lot of these issues. The way we would take the lead, say, on a $15 minimum wage or paid family leave, usually, not all the time, it's either us or California, sets that standard. So now you have $15 an hour, people are talking about it. We have the strongest paid family leave legislation in the country. Other states are starting to talk about it. So we sort of have those kind of conversations where it's like, okay, what's your legislative policy and how does that work in a state like New York? Okay, you get past that. Okay, whether it's the Me Too movement, how's that working in New York? What are some of the things you're implementing? I was just asked recently I was asked for our employee handbook. And we've had that handbook, I'm proud to say, for about 10 to 15 years. Sharing it now with other states and even with some unions who are saying, like, how do you do it in New York? How can we do this across the country? So I think it's in the nature of, you know, as a labor movement, you know, it's our it's within us to act like a family. We call each other brother and sister, but it really is a family aspect of it in terms of I don't have pride of ownership over anything. Even if we did something first, it's not my issue. It's all of ours. So there's already a comfort level with discussing political strategy, legislative strategy, and now whether it's social issues or otherwise. That is one benefit of who we are and what we do, because it's very easy for them to say, oh, you're New York, you have 2.5 million members. Yeah, you're going to get certain things done. I have 30, you know, there are states that have 35,000 union members in the entire state, and sometimes you can't really connect with them. Mm-hmm. But it helps when they recognize that if New York can set a standard, it will eventually help them to get to where they need to get to. So it's in that context.
Now, as long as we're talking about New York, we have an extraordinary thing going on in the state, which is a real sandbox fight between the governor of New York and the mayor of New York. What are you looking at me for?
It's your show, Alan. Yeah, I don't know.
So it is obviously unfortunate for a lot of people in your position to have to take sides on issues like this. How do you handle it?
I think you just work with the elected officials. I mean, I'll be honest with you. My jurisdiction is the state.
Right.
So I deal with the governor. Much, much less interaction with the mayor because we allow the Central Labor Council in New York City to do that. So for us, it's really straightforward. It's about speaking with the governor, working with the governor to further the cause of working people.
Do you ever say, hey, Andrew, cut it out. This kind of bullying is not well received. It's hurting our membership. Cut it out. Don't do that.
Now, look, I'm not going to tell the governor how to go about his business, and I don't know that the governor's doing that. What I do know is that I can talk to him.
Yeah, go ahead.
No,
I'm sorry.
But you get what I'm saying. My point is I can work with him on issues that affect our members. If there's anything detrimental as a result of anything, then I have a responsibility to say something. Other than that, I assume the governor is working or trying to work with everyone to the best of his ability things done.
At the workers' day of action in Foley Square, the governor spoke. He was very pro-labor. And
Foley Square, right down there near that trial that's going on here.
But the mayor was there, the governor was there,
and you had
elected officials there.
The mayor was there. You know, we have to see that they're both on our side on this issue. It's crucial for us to have that kind of support.
Do you get FaceTime, Mario, with the governor?
Yeah, we have 2.5 million members. He takes it seriously, and I speak to him on a regular basis.
Well, some people say he's a bully. Is he?
Hasn't been a bully with me.
No, he's been nice to you.
Yeah. Well, I think it's not necessarily, well, it's me, I appreciate it, but it's really the 2.5 million members I represent. If he or any elected official would act in that manner toward me, it's really a reflection on how they feel about the membership. So, no, I haven't had that problem.
So, given your a choice, Mario, and I don't certainly want to leave Andy out of this, but would you like to be the, you know, the head guy for the whole United States of the AFL-CIO? Yeah.
I appreciate the thought, but I am happy. I have my daughters are 14, 12, and 7 years old. They have a life here, and I'm much further along in my life than I thought I'd be at 49, so I'm pleased with where I am, though.
Yeah. And is there a mobilization technique that you guys are relying on now to bring more people into the union? Obviously, it hasn't worked up to now that well. You're pointing out that Donald Trump has helped things along a little bit in terms
of... Well, yeah, 75,000 members and a quarter, and 260,000 in the country in the last year.
Yeah,
additional
right.
members.
Right. So are you benefiting by Trump's being an incumbent?
Well, I think a lot of our members realize that they could lose something under this administration. So folks that don't have a voice would want a voice. We just organized a charter school. So we have a lot of charter schools that would like to be a part of NYSET. And why would a charter school teacher or employee want to be part of NYSET? They would have to pay dues, right? So why? Because then they would have a voice in the workplace. Then they would get better pay, better working conditions. And this is all why people want unions. So I think your last question ties it all in of why would someone want to join this movement and pay dues? Because they will get so much for it. And they are coming to NYSET. They are joining. We are growing. And that is a key piece.
So we only have a minute or so, but that's very interesting about the charter school thing, because as we know, the unions had some real problems with the charter schools in the beginning. And maybe after a while working in some of those conditions, some of those folks say, hey, I know why we need a union. I forgot that.
Right. And this is key for us that they want to be organized. And
we're not talking all charter schools here, Andy. We're talking a few.
Right. We're talking a few. But I think as time goes by and they realize who has it much better as far as working conditions and pay and all the other things that go with it, they will say maybe it is good for us to join that union, even though we'll have to pay dues. But it's much better. It's a much better place for them.
To which I say, where's Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie when you need them? It's been great having you guys. We've been talking with Mario Cilento, president of the New York State AFL-CIO, Andrew Pallotta, president of the New York State United Teachers Union, NYSET, about a major union case, the Janus case, before the Supreme Court. You stay tuned. I'm sure these guys will come back and talk to us more about it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.